This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
One of the most fascinating halachas in this week's Seder, because it is different in every way to every other halacha, both philosophically and practically, that we have in the Torah. And that is the strange concept of the Nazir. A Nazirite who undertakes for a period of 30 days not to drink wine or anything related to wine, nor to cut his hair or shave for that period of 30 days. And the difficulties there are, philosophically, that the concept of the Nazir goes against some very fundamental principles of Yiddishkeit. Strange thing to say about the halacha in the Torah, that seems to go against fundamental principles of Yiddishkeit, but that's what it looks like. And this is the Rambam, who says in the third perek of Hilchos Deos, the famous Rambam that one needs to learn over and over again, Shema Yomer Odom, a man might say, Hoyil v'hakino v'hatayvo v'hakovu d'chayitze bohem derech ro, since jealousy, ambition, desire, honor are all terrible things. And if we learn Pirkei Avos, we see they destroy a man's life, they can take you out of the world, they can totally wipe you out. Efrosh mehen b'yoseh, I must distance myself as far as possible. Something so dangerous that it can remove me from the world, there I must remove myself as far as possible from such a thing. And I must go to the other end, the other extreme. Ad shelo yoichel boso, and such a person will stop eating meat, not because he's a vegetarian, but because he wants to cut down on the physical pleasures of this world. Velo yishte yayin, and he will not drink wine. Velo yiso isho, he won't get married. Velo yeshev bediro no'o, he won't live in a pleasant home. He'll live in a run-down little home, even though he can afford better. He wants to understate it. Velo yilbash malbush no'en, he won't dress nicely. Elo asak v'atzem rakoshe, he'll wear very coarse materials. Uch yetzebehen, kigoyen hani ha'ivdei kechovim, like some of the non-Jewish saints practice. Gamze derech rohi v'osu leilech bo. This too is an evil path, and it is forbidden to follow it. Strong lashon, strong words. Evil path, and it's forbidden to follow. Hamahalech b'derech zu nikra chote. And one who does follow such a path is considered a sinner. Absolutely forbidden. I think if anybody today would publish a view like this, they would ban him. Rambam says a chote, you can't do that. And where's the proof of the Rambam that he's called a sinner? From our parsha. Sharehu omer b'nozir. Because in the case of the Nozir, it says that at the end of his 30-day period, he's got to bring a sin offering. Bechiper olov me'asher choto ala nefesh, to atone for the sins he'd committed. Omru chachomim and chazal say, Uma im Nozir shelo pirish elo min hayayin. What is the sin of a Nozir? This Nozir is considered so holy, what a wonderful thing he did. Why does he have to bring a sin offering of all things? Say chazal, because he didn't have wine for 30 days. And the Chazal make a kal vachomer. If a Nozir, just for distancing himself or separating himself from one product, wine, tzorich kaporo, he needs atonement for that. That's a sin. Hamunea atzmo michol dova v'dova halachas kama v'kama. If a person separates himself from all sorts of other things, how much more so does he need kaporo? Does he need atonement? So much for our vegetarian friends. Lefichach tzivu chachomim sheloi yimno odom atzmoi elamidvorim shemenato hatoiro bilva. Therefore the Torah instructs that a person is not permitted to prohibit upon himself anything more than the Torah prohibits itself. V'lo yehe oyser atzmo binadorim uvishvus, and he shouldn't undertake oaths and swear to himself al dvorim hamutorim, to prohibit things which the Torah allows. Kach omru chachomim, Chazal say further, Loi dayecho mashu osro Torah, elo shato yisro elecho dvorim achirim. Is it not sufficient? The Torah hasn't made enough prohibitions. You're still looking for more prohibitions. So we're not meant to revel in the fact that things are prohibited. We're almost meant to feel restricted by it. It's avodas Hashem that we've got to do. What can we do? It's not a question of finding that so pleasurable.
ובכלל הזה אלו שמסענים תלמיד אינם בדרך טוב, and therefore those who fast very often are not doing the right thing. Also חכמים שידעו מסגף עצמו בצענס, וחכמים forbade us to punish ourselves with fasting. ועל כל הדברים האלו חייצו במציב השלימה, ואומר, that's what Shlomo meant when he said, אל תהי צדיק הרבה. Don't be too much of a tzaddik. There's such a thing as being too much of a tzaddik. You've got to keep the halacha. The Torah lays down what you've got to keep, and that's it. From this, it would seem that the Noz is a really naughty boy. And look what he did. He prohibits things more than the Torah prohibits. He undertook things more than the Torah instructs him to undertake. And in fact, he has to bring a korban chatas. He has to bring a sin offering. And yet, when we look at the way the Torah regards him, the Torah introduces the parasha by saying, "Isho, isho, ki yafli lindo neder nozil hazil Hashem." If a person undertakes the wonderful step of declaring himself a nozil, Rashi learns that yafli means separation, but the Ibn Ezra learns, "Yase dovar pele." He's doing the most amazing thing in this undertaking. The Torah relates what he's not allowed to do, what he's not allowed to drink, and so on. Kodesh, kodesh yihye. Until the day, the period of his Nazirus has been fulfilled, Kodosh Yehi. He's a holy person. Kol Yemei Haziru LaHashem, all the period of his Nazirus, Al Nefesh Meis Lo Yovoi. He's not allowed to be Metame to a Meis, he's not allowed to come near a dead body like a Kohen. And what kind of Kohen? Even if his father or mother or brother or sister die, he's not allowed to go to attend to their bodies unless there's nobody else to do so. That's like the din of a Kohen Gadol. That's not just an ordinary Kohen. That means he has the level of Kedusha equivalent to that of the only man who's allowed to, once a year, to walk into the Kodesh Kedoshim, the Kohen Gadol, the man who has the highest level of sanctity in our society. The Nozir is able to reach that level. Kol Yemei Nizroi Kodesh Hu LaHashem. Again, the Torah says, throughout the period of his Nazirus, he is holy to the Ribbono Shel Olam. So there's a contradiction in this halacha. On the one hand, the Torah refers to him in the most glowing of terms, and on the other hand, the Rambam says he brings a korban chatos, he brings a sin offering, because he restricted himself from things that he shouldn't have been restricted. And both are difficult. How many people in the world are there who go through a 30-day period without cutting their hair or without drinking wine? Lots and lots of people. Leave aside Kiddush. Does everybody drink wine every day? Does everybody? There are lots of people in the world, Jews, non-Jews. Is it such a big deal for 30 days not to drink wine? For 30 days not to cut your hair? And it's not even as bad as Sfira in the 3 weeks. It doesn't say you can't listen to music. That one can understand would be difficult for a person to tolerate. But just a bit of wine not to have and not to cut his hair, what's so difficult about that? So on the one hand, it's difficult to understand what's his terrible sin. Lots of people don't drink. On the other hand, it's difficult to understand what's so wonderful about him. Lots of people don't drink. And the Medrash says, in fact, Kol Yomei Aziru LaHashem Borei Shekol Misha Mekadesh Es Atzmei Milamata Makdishin Oysa Milamala. This sanctity that he acquires is not because he's done something so terribly wonderful. Because we have a principle that anybody who sanctifies himself down here with physical methods, Hashem sanctifies him from above. L'fisha mazir es atzmi min hayayin, v'noeg tzar ba'atzmi. Since he withdraws himself from wine, and he conducts himself a little bit uncomfortably by not cutting his hair, shelo yegaleach reisha kedei lishmer atzmi min ha'aveiro, so as to keep himself away from aveiro. Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Arei Hu Choshiv Lefanai K'Kohen Gadol. Hashem says, to me this man is like a Kohen Gadol. What's he done? Just a little thing. But Hashem is prepared to give him the status of a Kohen Gadol for that. Bo Re'ei Kamo HaMitzvahs Ma'atreis Yisroel. Come and see to what degree the mitzvahs crown and elevate Yisroel. V'haloi Gadol Seyar Nivul Hu La'odah. To leave your hair unattended is an ugly thing for a person to do. You don't wash your hair, you don't groom your hair, you don't let it grow wild. Ulefishu megadle l'shem shemayim, but since he does it for l'shem shemayim for the right reasons, kroa kosuv atoro l'roshu. The Torah says it's a crown. What does the Medrash mean? He does something which is inherently unpleasant and ugly, but because he does it for the right reason, it becomes beautiful and it becomes a crown. That also is contradictory. That's also something difficult to understand. We hold that the principle of the Rochel Darchei Noam, the ways of the Torah, are pleasant. To have a mitzvah which is inherently ugly, it also doesn't seem to make much sense. So there's a lot of contradiction in this parsha of Moshe. In the late issue this morning, we dealt with a concept that we've dealt with on and off in various shiurim of the role and the roles and the interrelationships, or interrelationship of structure and content. We build structures. Well, the structures can have one of two purposes. The one is to contain the content. The other purpose of a structure can be to protect the content from the environment, to protect the content from the outside world. So we build a structure, we build a house, we build a building. What for? On the one hand, it contains the family, it contains the people, and on the other hand, it protects them from the elements. And what needs to be analyzed both in our day-to-day living and in a Torah sense is the relationship between the structure and the content and their relative purposes. What brought us onto it in the late issue was an impending battle between Yisrael led by Gideon and an alliance of nations led by the Midianites. And the Ribbono Shel Olam reduces Gideon's army to a number of 300 eventually. It starts off with many thousands, many tens of thousands, and at the end he lands up with a handful of people, with 300 people. The people that have been eliminated, he started off with nearly 30,000. Of the 30,000, God eliminates and eliminates, and they're left with 300. Who does God eliminate? Two categories of people. The first category of people are people who are scared that they're not of a sufficiently high spiritual status to justify the performance of miracles. They feel that they're not holding there, they're not tzaddikim. So all those people had to leave. In addition to that, he conducts a test, and the way we interpreted the test based on the Akedah was he took them when they were thirsty to the river, and he watched them to see how they drink the water. Some of them remained upright, scooped the water into their hands, and licked the water out of their hands. And others knelt down and drank directly from the river. And we understood the difference to be that the stature and the dignity of the human being is represented by his bearing, by the way he stands. And to drink water while you're standing, without a cup, using your hands, is a very inefficient way to drink water. You land up getting a small part of the water that you originally scoop up into your mouth. And particularly if you're going to do it in a dignified way, that's why they licked it. They didn't slurp the water up. That's rude when you're in the company of other people to drink water in that way. So the only way they could drink the water quietly and politely is to lick it. So you've got, using your tongue, so you've got the water scooped in your hands, you've brought it up from the bottom, water is leaking all the time, and then you're licking, which means it goes very slowly, so you get a few licks and a few drops go through your fingers, and between the licks, there's not much water left, and you have to go down and pick up some more. So it's an extremely inefficient way to drink water. And the others drank efficiently. They got down on their hands and knees, and they put their faces in the water, and they drank. Who would one think one would want for a soldier? The person who drinks most efficiently and quickly, or the person who makes a mess of it? Gideon is instructed to take the people who make a mess of it. Because what they weren't willing to do was to sacrifice their dignity in order to increase the efficiency of their eating. That's what it really meant. They weren't willing to stoop down to quench their thirst a little faster. That they weren't prepared to do. If it takes a little longer, design a little longer. We gave the example of the people at buffet dinners. You've got some people who are willing to rush up to the table and to elbow their way and to pile their plates and to stretch over and to push people out of their way, anything just to get to the food. They're willing to sacrifice their human dignity for food, and there's very little that one can find that is as ugly and off-putting as that. And some people will sit around and will wait. So what'll be the worst? By the time they get to the table, there's nothing left, so they'll go home and have supper. They didn't come to the simcha because they've got nothing at home. They didn't come to the simcha because they're hungry. They came to the simcha to share with the balei simcha, to sacrifice their dignity that they're not prepared to do. So there'll be no food, or there'll only be little things, or their favorite dishes won't be there. There'll be something else. Okay, that's what they'll have. And they wait till the crowd is over, and then they go, but you mustn't all do that now, because then the crowd will just wait, and then so it still won't do. So those of you who used to rush up, you must still rush up so that the mention can have a time to go. So the Rabbi Yishalom rids the army of anybody who lacks dignity and anybody who lacks tzidkus. So he's left with tzaddikim of high stature, but only 300 of them, which is also interesting. That gives us an idea of the ratio, how many such people one can expect to find in a fine society. He started off with good people. Gilu himself was selected, so he selected the army as best he could, and from that the army went from some 30,000 down to 300, which we figured is 1%, I think. Is that right? Which is that's the kind of ratio. Out of every 100 people, you can expect to find one mensch. And people often get disillusioned. Well, I thought religious society and you people would be, if the ratio is 1% or more of nice people, then you've got to be very elated. That's fantastic. There's nothing to get depressed and miserable about if 1 in 100 are fine. If it's much less than that, that's something to start getting worried about. But if you can find 1 in 100 people who are really special, who have dignity, who have refinement, who have character, who are Yorei Shamayim, you're doing very well. There's nothing to be disappointed about. Gideon couldn't do better. That's it. That's human nature. And now these 300 men have to tackle the camp of Midian. So Hashem says to Gideon, you're ready now, you can go and attack them. By the way, the camps of Midian had 150,000 soldiers, well armed. So the ratio now is 300 to 150,000. Okay, we worked out this morning what that was. 1 to 500, was it? 1 to 500. That was the ratio. People used to predict that South Africa had no future because there's a 1 to 5 ratio of white to blacks. That Israel couldn't exist because there's a 1 to 80 ratio of Jews to Arabs. It doesn't work that way. That's not the way that conflict is resolved. It's never resolved by numbers. There are other issues. And God says to Gideon, you can go now, you'll win. And if you don't believe me, he says to Gideon, you take your young man and go down and scout around, go and spy on them, and you'll see that I'm right. As we discussed this morning, it's an odd thing for God to say. And Gideon goes down with his young man to spy, and he hears one person telling another person a dream. One Midianite telling another Midianite a dream. But there was a loaf of barley bread floating around upside down in the camp of Midian. This loaf of bread struck a tent. The tent fell over, turned upside down, and then collapsed. So his friend says to him, that's Gideon. Hashem has given us all into the hands of Gideon. That's how the other Midianite interprets the dream. Which leads Gideon then to go back to his own men and to say, okay, we can now go. They're finished. We're off on to attack them. And the 300 men go. And interestingly enough, how are they armed? In their one hand they carry an empty vessel with a candle, and in the other hand they carry a shofar. That's it. Not one of them had a sword. And so as not to keep you in suspense, the end of the story is they do win. What's the meaning of that dream we analyzed? The tent is structure. The bread is energy. The bread is the dynamics of life. And if one looks at the two objects, a structure, a building on the one hand, and a loaf of bread on the other, which is stronger? The building is stronger. If you throw the loaf of bread at the building is not going to fall down. So when you compare structure with structure, you've got to look at quantities. You're comparing the structure of the bread, its molecular structure, its mass, compared to the molecular structure of the Empire State's building, then you've got to conclude that the bread doesn't stand a chance. You can throw a loaf of bread at the Empire State Building, it's not going to fall down. But in the dream of the Midianite, it did fall down. And they saw relevance to that. Because at the end of the day, people who are fed on bread can bring the Empire State Building down. So bread is stronger. Bread can produce the energy needed to be able to destroy the Empire State Building as well. But it's energy, it's not matter against matter. It's not structure against structure. This is dynamicism against structure. This is something dynamic against something static. This is energy against matter. It's a completely different thing. When you're talking energy against matter, then you can't weigh up how much energy in terms of its structure and how much matter in terms of its structure. These are two different things. Energy, that's a completely different story. And the Midianites who were discussing this dream realized that Gideon was not going to be fighting with structure. Gideon was going to be fighting with energy, with spiritual energy, with conviction, with brilliance, with all sorts of spiritual forces that no structure can withstand. And that's the absurdity of the argument that people used to give against South Africa or against Israel or many other such situations. It's irrelevant how many are on the one side and how many are on the other side. How many battles have been won in history by the smaller armies? I don't know enough about it, but I wouldn't be surprised if the majority of battles that have been won have been by smaller armies. They're more subtle, they're quicker, they're more responsive. There are all sorts of reasons why an army wins a battle. The relative size of the army really doesn't make much difference at all. Remember in Time magazine before the Gulf War how they always used to have these comparisons between what the Americans had there and what the Iraqis had, and it looked quite unfavorable to the Allies. There was no time, even at the end when America's arms were fully massed, it still didn't look favorable. And when you look how it was totally irrelevant, it just didn't matter. They didn't get a chance to use those weapons. Israel and the Six-Day War. Look at that, the tremendous power of the air forces of the other side. They didn't get a chance to use it. It was irrelevant. When you're comparing structure against structure, yes. But when you're comparing energy, when you're comparing content against container, that's a different thing altogether. You can't weigh them up in order to reach a decision as to which is the more powerful. And so, a structure alone is not sufficient to protect against the pressures of outside. And we find this in many different areas. We find this in the area of the human sciences. That what we're trying to do nowadays is, for human beings are living, as I mentioned in Shul last night, human beings today throughout the world are living under the most phenomenal tensions. In a way, the tensions are worse even than during the Great Depression of the 1930s. Because that was one pressure. It was an economic pressure. It was a very heavy economic pressure. It was a terrible pressure. And for many, many families, it was a thing that, as we know, drove hundreds of people to suicide. It was a terrible thing. But it was one pressure. Today, the pressure is coming from all sides. The pressures are social, the pressures are political, the pressures are security, the pressures are economic, the pressures are religious, the pressures are educational, the pressures are competitiveness. There's just dozens and dozens of pressures that we're up against all the time, without a stop. And the change that is taking place so fast in so many parts of the world, the change which is affecting people. Before, you used to be affected by things that happened in your backyard, and a little bit further than that. Now we're affected almost instantaneously by changes that take place thousands of miles away. The dramatic changes that are taking place in South Africa at the moment are a direct result of the changes that took place in Eastern Europe. And look how quickly it happened. Eastern Europe, the changes took place, started taking place, when was it, November a year ago? 18 months ago. And within weeks, the changes were happening here already. Within weeks. As dramatic. We can't really cope with that. We're under pressure. So what we do in order to try and handle that pressure is to strengthen the structures. The structures in which we live, with which we live. And sometimes those structures are external to ourselves, sometimes those structures are within ourselves. So we try and handle the competitiveness and the economic situation by educating ourselves and educating our children and give them professions and give them trades. Sure, that's important, but that's not going to solve it. You can qualify a person up to the hilt, but if he doesn't have a creative mind, if he doesn't have the drive, if he doesn't have the ambition, if he doesn't have the imagination, if he doesn't have the vision, it doesn't help. It doesn't help him. And if he has got all that, then the education is a little bit of a bonus, but he could manage without it. The truth is that if there's content, you can manage with very limited structure. If there's no content, it doesn't matter how strong the structure is, it doesn't really help. I've often appealed to students not to give up their learning program while they're studying for their exams. because it doesn't help. Because your learning improves internally. It affects your whole internal motivation. It makes you feel good. It drives you. It makes you creative. It gives you internal energy. Your swatting is just structure. You're just learning facts and techniques which you're going to have to give out. The more energetic you are inside, the less you need that structure. The more you can manage with limited structure. And if there's a choice of putting time in, rather put the time in. That doesn't mean you can get away without swatting. That doesn't mean you can get away without knowing your subject. But you can achieve much more with a creative mind that's operating at peak performance on limited structure than you can knowing all there is to know, if it's a good examination, knowing all there is to know and not having that creative mind, not being fast, not being sharp, not being generating ideas as you go along. And it's a sign of a good examination. I'm quite pleased when a student does give up his learning program in order to swat for his exams and he fails. I feel a lot of derech eretz for the examiner. That's good. That means that he's picking up the right things. He's picking up the creative drive of the person, not just the knowledge. We try and solve pressure problems by increasing the structure. When companies suffer losses through theft, what do? Increase the security system. Does that really address the problem? It doesn't. So now the Ganovim start working out how to get around the new security systems, that's all. And how long does it take before they find out the technique? It's structure against structure, it's technique against technique. We'll develop a skill to catch the Ganovim, and the Ganovim will develop the skill to fox the security system. And who's got more at stake? Who's really got a greater interest in winning? The Ganov. For him it's a matter of life and death virtually. He lives on that, that's his livelihood. For the company that's putting in the security system, it's a matter of just increasing their profits or preserving their profit level. It's not a matter of life and death if the Ganovim are there. So at the end of the day, who's going to put more energy into beating the system? The security people or the Ganovim? The Ganovim will do it. So they'll always win. And it's just a matter of constantly improving the security system. It will go on and on and on to a level of absurdity. We discussed, I think, recently, just before I went away, the obsession with perfection in technology, which is also a lack of the content. The more a person really appreciates the spiritual side, the artistic side of his music, the less he needs hi-fi perfection. It's the people who don't really understand it all that well that have this quest for perfection in their equipment. The structure must be perfect. Structure doesn't have to be perfect if the contents are there. If the contents are there, that's where the enjoyment comes from. And when the contents are there, you overlook all sorts of imperfections in the structure. It doesn't matter. You live with it. You don't even notice it. But when the content isn't there, every little thing becomes an issue. Every little crackle. In the old days, people used to listen to those old-fashioned records. Most of you don't even remember them. It was before you were born. But they remember those records. They used to crackle like anything. And people used to love it. People used to listen for hours to it on those old gramophones. With valves that you have to heat it up before you started playing, and then you have to put these things and change the needles every little while, and people used to love their music. And now you listen to it and you say, how could they have listened to that? How could you possibly listen to it? And they loved it. And they grew and they developed it from it. It didn't bother them. Today it bothers us. Why? Not because we've got something so good. It's because we're so empty inside that all we can worry about is the structure, the perfection of the structure. You find it in institutions, our own included. When a person's content is going well, when he's involved, he's learning, he's creative, he's thinking, he's dynamic. Little odds and ends that aren't quite right. Something's wrong here, something's wrong there, somebody said something they shouldn't have said. Doesn't bother him. He lives with it and he gets on with life. He doesn't make an issue out of it. When does a person make an issue out of it? When he becomes obsessed with the structure. Because he's empty inside. And so he's looking around outside. His sense of well-being, his sense of security comes from perfection in the structure. If everything around him is perfect, he thinks he'll feel better. He won't feel better. He goes on in his obsession with the search for perfection in things outside of him. And that really is one of the differences between the Christian approach and our own approach. The one seeking perfection outside and the one seeking perfection inside. When you go on a tour of any great European city, what do they show you? The cathedrals. They're beautiful. Absolutely magnificent. Perfection, artistic perfection in the outside. When you go to Eretz Yisrael, if you're going to go and look at the yeshivas and the shtibulach, you're not going to be very elevated by the buildings. There you've got to look at the people. And you've got to look very closely at the people to be able to notice that that same artistic perfection is expressed in conduct rather than in an object. It's a difference. and we must be careful not to lose that. The bread represents the content, the energy, the dynamicism, the drive. The tent represents the structure. And Midian realizes that this war is going to be won with energy, it's not going to be won with structure. And all wars are won, all battles, whether they're military battles or they're human battles or personal battles, all battles are won with content. They're won with energy, they're won with motivation, they're won with value systems, not with structure. And how does it work in Yiddishkeit itself? We have structure and we have content. And that was the thrill that the Ribbono Shel Olam got out of Bnei Yisrael's answer when he offered them the Torah. Because what did they say? Naaseh v'nishma. We will do and we will study. Nishma means we will hear, we will listen. When you use the image of listening, you're talking about content. You can't listen to structure. You can only see structure. You can handle structure, you can manipulate structure. You can't hear structure. And likewise, you can't handle values. You can't handle content. You can't see content. You can't see values. So when we use the image of hearing, we're talking about values. When we use the image of seeing, or the image of touching, feeling, manipulating, we're talking about structure. Naaseh v'nishma means we will build the structure and fill that structure with content. Naaseh, first we will do, we will build, and then nishma, we'll listen to what we've done. And we'll fill the structure with content. Today we don't see that as such a chiddush because we take that for granted. Today we're living in a society that places all its emphasis on the naaseh. All its emphasis is on the engineering side, on the structural side, both in secular society and religious society, both Jewish religions and other religions. We're living in a society that emphasizes the structural. But all that came as a result of what the Jewish people taught, the importance of structure. Up until that point, there was no importance to structure. There was no structure. There was no philosophic structure. There was no educational structure. There was no religious structure. There was no value system structure. And that's why the Ribbono Shel Olam was so thrilled with Yisrael saying, Naaseh v'nishma, the realization that structure has to come first. And the mitzvah, the halachic system, is the structure. And when Israel realized, without having any pre-experience of it all, that that has to come first, there has to be a structural perfection first in the system that will govern them, and then they can fill that with content. Now with that background, let's re-examine the Nozir. The Nozir is doing an interesting thing. He is not satisfying himself with the structure of Halacha. He is taking upon himself an additional structure, which is not obligatory. It's true that provision is made for the structure in Halacha, the Torah makes provision for such a structure, but it's not a structure which is imposed on all the nation. On the contrary. And he takes the structure, and what does he do? It's purely structural. He utters a phrase, he utters a formula, the consequence of which are a string of halachas that restrict his interaction with the world more than the ordinary Jew is restricted. The result of that is Kedusha. So in a sense, he's going the Naaseh v'nishma route, he's starting with structure, and then he's putting content into it. But he's starting with a type of structure which the Rambam in the name of Chazal criticize. What is the structure he's doing? He's imposing upon himself further limitations and further prohibitions than those already imposed by the Torah. Now the Medrash makes a very interesting comment and says, Nidroi toloi benezirusoi veloi nezirusoi benidroi. His oath is a function of his nezirus, not his nezirus a function of his oath. What does that mean? We would have thought, without any question, that the formula comes first, and the result of that formula, he has to say, I undertake upon myself to be a nozir. And we would think the result of uttering that formula is now the imposition of the laws of the nozir. So that the nezirus, the state of being a nozir, is a result of undertaking that role by uttering the formula, by making the neder, taking the oath of nezirus. Says the Midrash, that's not so. You think that the neder, you think the oath is the cause, and the nezirus, the state, is the consequence. No. The status is the cause, and the neder, the formula, is the consequence. Which means he's got to start off with the content and then take on the container, which is opposite to the Naaseh v'nishma principle. which is quite fascinating. He must first have within himself the need to be a nazir, and then express it. We have the same concept in a way in our whole attitude to conversion. Iman of Sheikh, either way, if we hold the Torah is such a wonderful thing, why don't we go around converting people, as other religions do? And if we don't, if we say we don't want converts, we're racists, we don't believe that anybody else can join our exclusive club, then why do we admit converts altogether? So what do we really hold? So what we hold is that we cannot impose a structure on a non-Jew who doesn't have the content that needs that structure. That's what we're saying. A non-Jew has a structure of the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach. That's his structure. Seven Mitzvahs of B'nai Noach and all their consequences. It's quite a broad thing. It's not just seven principles, because one of those principles is to construct a legal system. So the Goy, the non-Jew, has the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach and all that emanates from it as his halachic structure in which he needs to operate. The only way we can shift him into Yiddishkeit, into Torah, is to give him a new structure and say, look, if you want, let's rather become a Jew. Now you're governed by the Shulchan Aruch, which means we are now giving him a container over and above anything that he needs. That we don't do. With the non-Jew, we're not going to go the Na'aseh V'nishma route. We're not going to say, look, take it on. Don't worry. Take it on like we did. We were at Sinai. What did we know about it? We accepted it. And after we accepted it, we grew into it. So you do the same. That's what other religions do. When it comes to a matter of converting, that's what they're saying here. Take it on, and you'll be saved, and everything will be alright, and you'll grow into it, it will be okay. We don't say that. We're not willing to say that. But if a non-Jew says, my container's overflowing, I don't have the structure to express myself religiously, the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach are not enough for me, I need more than that, then we welcome him with open hands. Now the content has preceded the structure, and he needs the structure which we gladly give him. Just as we do with ourselves in the case of Nazirus, as the Midrash says. We don't impose Nazirus on anybody else. We don't compel anybody to become a Nazir. We don't even compel ourselves in Nazirus. We're not permitted to take the Nazirus on and grow into it and then fill it and say, the first thing is I want to be a Nazir. Right, number one. Now I'll try and get the feeling for it afterwards. Which is the way we approach all other halachas. How do we approach the Shulchan Aruch? We say, you better do it, my friend. That's all there is. A person comes along who's not keeping Shabbos. We say, we try and educate him, we motivate him, but basically you've got to start doing it. You can't wait until you're 80 years old and you understand all the halachas before you do it. You start doing it now. And you'll grow into it. You'll get the feel. But when it comes to Nazirus, we don't say that. Take it on. Become a Nazir and you'll grow into it. We don't say that. We say, Nidroi toli b'Nazirus. Only if you feel the urge and the need to express yourself in this way and you don't have enough structure within Yiddishkeit, even what the Torah gives you is not sufficient structure for your content. You have such a desire for Kedusha that you've outstretched the container of the Torah even, that the structure of the Torah is no longer adequate. Now you're permitted to extend that structure for a limited period of 30 days in order to express that religious feeling which you have, which cannot be expressed otherwise. The same as we do with a non-Jew who wishes to convert. If you're at the point where your structure is insufficient for your content, we're happy to increase the structure for you, join our structure, and that will then suffice. And if we look at the Meforshim a little bit clearer, we see that concept. Ibn Ezra, when he says that taking it on ki yafli means to do an amazing thing. What's so amazing about becoming a Nazir? Ki rov ho'ilom hulchim achar ta'avosam. Because most people follow their desires. And this person is going against that. This person is removing himself from things which one should normally want, to have a glass of wine, to groom oneself, those are normal things, and he's going against the trend. And that's a wonderful thing. What does it mean it's a wonderful thing to go against the trend? What does it mean it's a wonderful thing to cut out experiences which the Torah allows you? To cut out experiences, as the Rambam says, we're not permitted to do that. So why is this so wonderful? And to explain that part of it, I'm going to deviate for a moment to a principle that I have done with you before, and we'll do it again, and we'll apply it to this situation. Tosfos says on Daf Lamed Zayin Amud Aleph in Brochus, Borei Nefoshes Rabbeis V'Chesroinon, explaining the Brocha Achroina that we glibly say very quickly after we've eaten anything. What does it mean? So he divides the Brocha into two sections. The first one is Borei Nefoshes Rabbeis V'Chesroinon. We thank Hashem for creating all these different souls, and Chesreinon is that without which they cannot survive. It says Tosfos kemo lechem u'mayim, such as bread and water, she'i efshar beloihem, without which one cannot live. So that's the first thing we're thanking Hashem for, the necessities of life, bread, water. And then the brocha goes on. The second part of the brocha is va'al kol ma she'boro la'chayos bohem nefesh kol chay. And additionally, we thank you, Hashem, for everything you have created to sustain all living flesh. Now that's a repetition of the first one, isn't it? Except this is a more general one. The first one is Chesreinon, that without which one cannot survive. The second one is Al Kol Ma Sheboro, everything you've created to sustain living flesh. What else have you created to sustain living flesh? Bread and water is all that's needed to sustain living flesh. So what does that part of it mean? Kaloma, that says Tosfos. Al Kol Ma Sheboro. Now I'm thanking you for everything else in the world, the entire world. Shegam im loy bero'o, yecholim ha'ilam lichyus b'loyim. Even though without those things the world could survive. I'm now thanking you, Hashem, for creating things without which we could have survived. It's fascinating. Two parts to the bracha. First part is to thank God for those things without which we couldn't survive. Second part is to thank God for those things without which we could survive. So why did God create them? Sheloi bero'om ki'im leta'anug ba'alma. The Ribbono Shel Olam created them just for fun. Not for His fun. For Alpha, to give us pleasure. Another one of these things, if it was published today, eyebrows would be raised. What kind of business is this? Pleasure? Just for pleasure? You take what you need to survive, and the rest you sit and you learn. That's it. And yet we see in the Brocha Achrona, it's not so simple. We are thanking Hashem also for those things that are created, Netanug Ba'alma, just for ordinary pleasure. Like apples and other such things. Exotic fruits. Different tastes, different colors, all sorts of different things which you don't need. But there's tainug, it brings man pleasure. There's a Rabbi Dessler, which my father quoted once when he spoke here, that talks about the fact, and I don't remember where he quoted from, that the stars were created to give man pleasure. And I don't have any major cosmic, God could have all the other cosmic functions that they perform, I could have managed without them. We certainly don't have to be able to see them. But the sky that one sees at night with all the beautiful stars from days out of town is there just to elevate man, just to exalt man, just to give man pleasure. Look how far the Ribbono Shel Olam goes. Look what he's created. These massive systems, these enormous goings on there. All these, just think what the universe is. And one of its main functions is just to give human beings pleasure. All these things, all the flowers in the world, all the grasses in the world, all the fruits in the world, the different tastes in the world, all this, why did Hashem create? The Tainug Ba'alma, just to give man pleasure. So, the question is, if it's the Tainug Ba'alma, if it's just for pleasure, then look at the wording again. The wording then is wrong. So I thank Hashem for creating so many people, Bechesreinom, that which without which we cannot survive, that's okay, bread and water. Second part, Va'al kol ma sheboro, and furthermore, I thank you, Hashem, for everything else you created. Which Tosfos says is l'tainug ba'alma, just for pleasure. But that's not what we say in the bracha. What do we say in the bracha? We don't say va'al kol ma sheboro so l'tainug ba'alma. We say al kol ma sheboro so la'chayos bo'em nefesh chay, to give chayos, to give life to people. So how can you interpret that second part of the bracha as going on things without which we can survive? It's not l'tainug ba'alma, we're thanking God for the things that give us life. What's the answer to that? That those things give us life. Because there's a difference between surviving and living. You can survive with bread and water. But if you're not having time, or if there's not pleasure in your existence, that's not called living. When a person, to see a person who's not, he's not enjoying life, that's not a person who's alive. To see a person with a sparkle in his eye and a smile on his face and a bit of dynamicism in the way he walks and in the way he talks, a person that can enthuse you. We talked last night about the wet blankets that can oppress you and depress you, and the people who actually elevate you and motivate you and make you feel good. And we suggested last night, a suggestion we must follow up in practice, that all the wet blankets should be locked behind bars. They shouldn't be allowed in the streets. Certainly shouldn't be allowed into the Beis HaMedrash. What kind of business is this to make other people miserable just because you're a wet blanket? So if one wants to be a wet blanket on your own. You've got no right to impose that on others. When you see a person who's able to elevate us, to make others feel good, that's because he's enjoying life. The tanugim is a matter of lahachayos for him. This is chayos, it's not a luxury. The pleasure itself is an essential. That's what Tosfos is telling us. That there are two kinds of essentials. There's that kind of essential without which you will die, and there's another kind of essential without which you won't die, but without which you won't live either. You can be in a state of flux which is neither life nor death. You're biologically alive, but that's about it. And that's not how it's meant to be. We've got to enjoy ourselves, we've got to have pleasure too, within the framework of the Torah and within the framework of Halacha, that Ribbono Shel Olam creates the wherewithal to have pleasure, to look at different colors. Why does Ribbono Shel Olam create so many different colors? Look how difficult it is, look how physically complex it was to create a world of color. Why didn't he just create a world of black and white? The young men who go into the army tell me that after basics, one of the things that strikes them most when they come out of their period of basics, if they haven't had time off, if they've been there for full 3 months, is the color in the world. But it's not a grey, black and white world, but the color strikes them, they're not used to it. And we take it all for granted. Why did the Ribbono Shel Olam create so many colors? So many colors! Why did he do it? The Tainug Ba'alam, it's chayus, it makes us feel alive. It creates variety, it creates a certain richness of being which makes us feel alive, and that's terribly important. So now comes another question, and that is, but what do we do with the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, where the Mishnah says, Kachi darko shel Torah, this is the way of Torah, pas b'melach toicha, all you should eat is bread and salt, v'mayim b'meshura tishte, you should drink a little bit of water, v'ala oretz tishon, and you should sleep on the floor, no seely postrophedics, straight on the floor. And if you are, then you'll be happy and fulfilled in Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba. That seems to be in direct contradiction. If that's the world, if that's Darko Shel Torah, then the question comes back again. So did God create this beautiful world just to distract us? Just to try and trick us? And to get us off the path? And in that case, what is Tosfos saying? Why do we thank God for all these beautiful things if that's not the Darko Shel Torah? And I explained last time we did this, that Kachi Darko Shel Torah means that is the ideal. A person should be able to find all the richness and variety, all the fun and all the pleasure that he needs within the Torah. If it is so, if a person finds everything he needs within the Torah, does he need the color? Does he need the apples and the oranges? Does he need the pretty flowers? He doesn't. All he needs then is bread and water. He needs the chesronon. He only needs that without which we cannot survive. That without which we cannot live dynamically, he doesn't need, because he's getting it all out of Torah. And the meaning of that Mishnah is, it is theoretically possible to get it all out of Torah. But now we come to a very dangerous point. And that is, what does an individual do who's not getting it all out of Torah? Which is 99% of us. We're not putting in the time that it takes to get it all out of Torah. We don't have the skills that it takes to get it all out of Torah. We don't have the purity. We're not tzaddikim enough to get it all out of Torah. We're just not holding there. Where if we're going to be honest with ourselves, we're not getting it all out of Torah. What do we do then? Do we say, well, but that's how it has to be, and all this narishkeit, all this nonsense of the pretty flowers and the beautiful sounds and the lovely views and the different tastes, that's not for me. I'm trying to get it all out of Torah. That we see from the Tosfos not. There has to be a richness of existence. There has to be tainug. There has to be pleasure. There has to be fun in what we're doing. The idea is to get that all in Torah, and we need to shift more and more into Torah, so that we're becoming more dependent on our Torah for it, and consequently less dependent on other things for it. But not to remove it, not to create a vacuum where you don't have that pleasure altogether. That's one of the big problems when one's becoming religious, when one's becoming a Baal Teshuva, is that the first thing that they start teaching you is what you're not allowed to do. So you start cutting out the sources of enrichment, the old sources of enrichment. And many of them you have to cut out, some of them you don't have to cut out quite so quickly. But that's what happens. The first thing is you start cutting out the old treif sources of enrichment. In fact, you learn to look at everything you used to do as being treif. I think I mentioned once before that I'm just waiting for the day when when teachers of Baalei Teshuva will start teaching Baalei Teshuva. The breathing also is one of the things that secular people do, and you used to do in your old life, and like everything else, this must now stop. It doesn't work that way. There's a great deal of richness in your old life, which you're not ready to throw out yet, because you can't substitute it with anything yet. And you've got to be terribly careful not to throw out the old richness before you can substitute it with new richness. So you have to find kosher ways of doing it. And I think in the last shiur I gave before I went overseas, I mentioned the recipes that the Gemara gives to achieve richness of experience, of apparently treif experiences, how to do it in a kosher sort of a way. But one can do that. It's possible to do that, and sometimes an individual needs to do that within the framework of halacha to experience a richness of existence that can allow him the tainug, that can allow him the pleasure. And then yes, as he gets more into it, that pleasure is, he gets that pleasure from other things. To tell a person, let's say he starts off with Shabbos, that's one of the most difficult things of all. So the Baal Tshuva comes along. What did he used to do on Shabbos? On Friday night he used to go to his family. Schlep, 6 kilometers, he used to go by car. They used to have a lovely family dinner and then sit down and watch a good video. And on Shabbos morning he used to go take his family on a picnic, and he used to go and this, that and the other. And Saturday night he would go to a good play or to a concert or whatever it was, and he would feel wonderful on Sunday morning. Now the poor fellow becomes through. So what do you do with him? Okay. Number one, we tell him, this business of going to visit your parents on Friday night and your family on Friday night, that you cut out. Can't do it? So the guy comes and he sits at home and he twiddles his thumb on Friday night. What can he do? The books you used to read, they're trash. So now you must just read art scrolls and you must read biographies of tzaddikim. So he sits there and he opens an art scroll, doesn't understand a word of it. He opens up a biography of the tzaddikim, falls asleep after a couple of minutes, and wakes up half an hour later, doesn't know what to do with himself. That's his Friday night. Shabbos morning, the picnic, that's out. He can't go to the picnic, go to shul. Comes to shul, doesn't know what's going on, doesn't understand the thing, frustrated as anything, goes home again, sleeps. Saturday night, you can't go, then you come to the Motzei Shabbos shul Saturday night. He steps along to the he schleps along to the Motzei Shabbos, doesn't understand very much of that either, and he's supposed to feel good. So what does he do? So he says to himself, well, it must just be because I'm inexperienced, this must be the real thing. And then he starts talking himself into a religion of deprivation, that the more he deprives himself, he actually starts reveling in the deprivations. This is it, I must be holy, and that's the cost of being holy, that's what it is. And he's actually restricted himself to a point where he has no input. He has no emotional input. He has no input of richness. Now, I'm not suggesting that the answer to that is that he doesn't make those changes. But one has to realize the responsibility of cutting something out. It has to be substituted with something that is equally inputting. You can't cut things out that were a source of pleasure and joy and meaning to a person without putting in its place something else which is as meaningful, if not more. That you can do. A child's holding on to something that you don't want him to hold, you can't just take it away from him. That's the deprivation. You take the one thing away from him, you give him something else which is permitted to hold, so that it's not deprivation. And you teach him that way what he can hold and what he can't hold. You're not saying you may not touch anything. You don't want to teach a child you may not touch, you may not hold, you may not make a noise, you may not this, you may not that. Eventually the child becomes totally inhibited and can't function as a normal adult afterwards. One has to be able to substitute so that he knows what he can and what he can't. So it is with religious education. As one becomes involved, one has to need to know what experiences one can involve oneself in and how one develops that same richness that one had before, if not much more richness, from sources which are kosher rather than from sources which are treif. Let's look back at the nozir now. What does the nozir do? The nozir is coming along, and this was our difficulty with the nozir, the Rambam mentioned. Cutting off sources of pleasure. What's in a glass of wine? What is it after all? So you can say a brocha. I'm not even talking about kiddush wine. And the wine that most people use for kiddush wine is a bit of a shiloh, but it's wine altogether. But we're talking about an ordinary glass of wine. What's in it? Yain yisamach levav enosh. It makes a person feel good. That's all. It just creates a nice feeling. Terrible thing. Is that a big issue? Well, from I don't know, the kind of approach that is developed nowadays in many religions, including our own, recently, maybe yes, one should cut it out. It's something terrible. Why? Because it makes you feel good, and we've just learned that if you're feeling good, there's something wrong. I used to feel good before I was frum, and that's when everything was bad, so that must be wrong. Since I'm frum, I don't feel good, and they tell me I'm doing the right thing, so obviously feeling good is a bad thing. But it isn't so. Yain yisamach levav enosh, nothing wrong with having a glass of wine. All under control, the right occasions, the right amount, the right time. Nothing wrong with feeling good. That is the lahachayus for him, nefesh kol chai. That's the chayus that we're talking about. Nothing wrong with it at all. Comes the nozir and says, no, I won't. anything wrong with combing your hair and having a haircut, looking good, feeling good as a result of that? What is it after all? What is the grooming? Grooming is to make you feel good. So both the wine and the grooming, which the nozir cuts out, are two different ways of making you feel good. One is structural and one is content, by the way. Drinking wine is an internal change that takes place, although it's a temporary change, and the grooming is an external change that takes place. Why should a person feel better when he dresses nicely? The fact is he does. When he dresses himself up, or her up, herself up, when he or she grooms herself or himself nicely, looks in the mirror, they look fine, they go out, they feel good. Why is that? When a clothes salesman understands, and a jewelry salesman understands, all these people understand that they're not selling objects, they're selling a feeling. And what they've got to do is they've got to get the person to feel good in the item that they're buying. If the person feels good, he'll pay a lot of money for that feeling. He's paying for the feeling, not for the cloth. So they're both feelings. One is a structural feeling, and one is an internal feeling. And the nozir cuts them both out. He says, I'm going to cut out that feeling good which comes from wine, I'm going to cut out that feeling good that comes out of being well groomed and well presented. And the Rambam warns us, that can be a problem, and we've seen too. What's he doing? Why is he cutting out this feeling good? The answer we find in the Sipurna. The Sipurna learns that the end of that phrase, of the opening sentence of this parsha, Ki yafli lindo neder nozir, if a person will do this wondrous thing of undertaking the oath of Nazirus, and bear in mind what the Midrash says, the oath comes after the feeling is there, not the other way around. But the Pasuk goes on with another two words, Lahazir Lahashem. He's becoming a Nozir for Hashem, not for himself. What does that mean, says the Sipurna? Lahazir Lahashem, Lahafrish Atznoi Mikol Eile. He wants to separate himself from all of these. Lamayim Yiyeh Kulo Lahashem, so that he can be more dedicated to God. To deal more in his Torah, to go in his ways, and to cleave to Hashem. This is not a diminishment of experience. This is not a diminishment of source of pleasure. It's merely a substitution. He is cutting down on his physical input in order to increase his spiritual input. Because he's come to the point where the physical inputs are in fact distracting him. And he needs to take that next step, which is to create a structure that enables him to remove himself a little bit further from the physical things in order to dedicate himself further to the spiritual things, because he understands that there is a mutual exclusivity. As one becomes more and more involved spiritually, so one's dependence on the physical becomes less and less. And that is correct, that as one is getting more of one's input from one's Torah, one needs the physical less. What I'm questioning and attacking is not the move from the physical to the spiritual, chas v'sholem. That's what Avodas Hashem is all about. What I'm criticizing is the fake move. When a person makes believe that he's moved, and he cuts out the physical before he's substituted with the spiritual, and he's left suspended in the middle with no input whatever. He's not really enjoying his Torah, he's not really enjoying his Gemara, he's not enjoying his Motzei Shabbos Shir, he's not enjoying his Shabbos altogether. That's the real truth of it if he faces up to it. He's not getting enough fulfillment out of it, and he's cut out all the rest, because he's holy, it's a nozir. And he lands up a wet blanket. It's exactly the kind of people we're talking about. Some of these wet blankets are very frum. So it's nothing to do with the level of frumkeit. In fact, many of them are very frum. And why one understands? Because there has been a lack of understanding of what to use and what not to use and how to use it. The principle is, there has to be chayus. A person has to be alive. A person has to be dynamic. It's not good enough for him to be surviving. It's not good enough for him to be biologically alive. He needs to be spiritually dynamic. There needs to be content inside that container. And until he's on the level, he's not going to get it all from Torah. He's going to need it from life. He's going to need that input from his day-to-day activities too. I remember once in Yeshiva, I was going through a particularly uncreative period, and I was very worried about it, because I just heard a talk from Rabbi Lipschitz a couple of weeks before that, to say that one reaches one's creative peak at about 23 years old, and that's about how old I was, and I was convinced this was now the end of it. That was it. I haven't been creative now for 2 weeks, so it's probably goodbye to creativity, and I got quite depressed about it. And I went to chat to Rabbi Lipschitz about it, and he said, well, what are you doing about it? What have you been doing? Well, I've been trying to learn more, I've been trying to learn different things, nothing works. Nice. He says, take the day off tomorrow, and go to Machne Yehuda, the marketplace. Walk around there for the whole day. And touch the fruit and smell it and talk to the traders and just to spend the day there. I looked at him and he was crazy, but a number of other items of advice that he'd given me had worked well, and I thought, well, why not? I'm wasting my time learning. I'm not doing anything. In any case, what can be wrong? And I tried it, and of course it worked. What is it? What does it mean? Just an understanding that there needs to be an input, and that you've just run out. You've hit against a stone wall. You're going around in circles. You just need to break out of it. And sometimes to break out of that, you just need life. That's all. Plain life. Talk to an ordinary trader. See life taking place. Watch people buying and selling fruit and vegetables. Touch it. Feel it. Look at the prices. Get that whole atmosphere. It's input. It all generates dynamicism. It generates chayus. It makes you feel alive again. Once you're feeling alive, you open the same piece of Gemara, you're creative again. It's quite easy after that. But the chayus has to be there. One has to realize that the Ribbono Shel Olam has provided an unlimited number of variants, of sources of chayus, of that life and that dynamics. Darko Shel Torah, the ideal is that one can get it 100% from Torah. Very few are the people who are in fact able to get it 100% from Torah. Very few indeed. Most of us need some kind of a combination. We can get a lot of it from our Torah. We also need other sources of input. And that source of input is the variety of life. Just being able to see and to experience ordinary things, different people. That's where we get our chayus from. The Nozir realizes that he gets to a point where he needs to withdraw further from life in order to concentrate further on his Torah. And yet the Rambam and Chazal warn, he's got to be careful, because this withdrawal from life, the structural change is a negative one. And the only reason the Torah elevates him to such a high level is provided that included in that structural change there is the necessary amount of content elevation. If the bigger structure is giving him more content, then he's okay, then he's Kodesh LaHashem. But if the bigger structure is merely structure and there is no further content, that's a Choteh, he has to bring a Korban. And that's why Shimon HaTzadik says in the Dorim, on Daftes, I think it is, that he never used to eat from the Korban of a Nozir. Because most of them he believed were not okay. Except one, and he gives an example of one person who he used to eat from, Shimon HaTzadik with a Kohen, whose Korban he ate from, because that particular Nozir he knew for 100% was an okay Nozir. But all the other Nozirim that came his way, he refused to eat from their Korban, because he felt it was highly unlikely, if not impossible, for a Nozir really, in the normal circumstances, for a Nozir really to be able to do this properly in a way which is positive and not negative. And that really explains our whole attitude to issues such as Yura, which we don't have time to go into in great detail, but just to touch on it in order to link it into this concept. Yura is what Chazal call the ostentationism of external mitzvahs. And that causes a bit of conflict, because on the one hand, there shouldn't be an ostentationism of external mitzvahs. On the other hand, what does one do? There's a mitzvah. Are we going to stop wearing a yarmulke because of Yura? Are we going to stop, you know, washing our hands in public before a meal because of Yura? What are we going to do? And here we see the principle. Yura does not refer to the structure which is imposed by the basic halacha. That's the Naaseh v'Nishma. The structure has to come first. And nobody can be accused by performing the normal structure of halacha. Nobody can be accused of Yura, of ostentationism. When is a thing ostentatious? A thing is ostentatious when the structure is too big for the content. That's when it becomes ostentatious. That's when it becomes incongruous. As long as there is a proper relationship between the content and the structure, it's not incongruous. Looks okay. As you know, I spent a few days in Vienna a week or two ago, and one of the things that was impressing me there was that everything's in a palace. Everything is in a palace. You go into an exhibition, it's in a palace. You go to an art gallery, it's a palace. Everything is unreal, real palaces. Unbelievable. That just struck me as an observation. It didn't bother me at all. And then they have a very interesting breed of horses called the Lipizzaner horses, which I'm sure you've heard about. Very choshev horses. So at one stage I had 3 hours spare, and I said to the concierge at my hotel, what's on this morning? Anything to see? Any concerts on? You know, he says, no, let's go and see the Lipizzaners. I said, that's a good idea. Where do I find them? And he says, in the such and such a palace. I said, what? Horses in the palace too? And he looked at me and he said, this has nothing to do with whether they're horses or people. It has to do with nobility. Palaces are a place for nobility. And these horses are not ordinary horses. They're noble horses. No, sorry. But, and it is in a palace. You watch these horses, the stables are in a palace. Chandeliers, these horses are running around doing their thing, these beautiful crystal chandeliers and murals on the wall. Meshuggah. Now why is that meshuggah? Because there's no relationship to the container and the content. When a palace houses a king, that's okay, one can understand it. When a palace houses a magnificent art exhibition, no, okay, one can understand that too. You have a musical concert in a palace, also makes a little bit of sense. But to have horses running around and stabling in a palace, that's a bit far, that's a bit much. How can one understand that? What is that? Structure completely out of proportion to the content for which it's meant. That's yura. That's when you're using the structure to show off, you're not using the structure to contain. And when a person's nazirus type of mitzvahs, that part of halacha which is not basic fundamental, it's something a little bit extra which he's doing, which many people might do, it doesn't matter, but it's not fundamental. When he practices that externalism without having the content to back it up, that's what Chazal call yura, that's when it becomes ostentation. And that principle of ostentation applies in all areas of life, not only in halacha. And so we've got to divide our activities into those where the structure is an essential part of the Naaseh V'Nishma principle. You need a structure. You can say a person builds himself a home, and let's say he's not yet married, he's planning to get married, and he builds himself a home. And you say, what's the house for? It's for my family. Where's your family? Not yet, coming. That's not ostentatious, that's not ridiculous. Preparing himself, you need a structure. The Rambam Pasul's La'alocha, one should have a home before one gets married, you would have somewhere to bring the wife to. Makes sense. But if a person builds himself a 20-room palace with all sorts of 20 rooms he builds, a bachelor, and we say, who's it for? For my family. Where's your family? It's coming, not yet. That's just out of proportion. One needs to know, yes, structures need to be provided even before the content, because there cannot be content if there's nothing to contain it. But there's a limit to the size and to the rigidity of that structure until the structure is full. Once the structure is full, we carry on building and we carry on building. And that's the approach that we like to adopt to our Avodas Hashem, to our whole career in Torah and Mitzvahs. To start with the structure is halacha. To fill that structure, the filling the structure is the understanding of the halacha, the feeling for the halacha, the interpersonal relationships that go around the halacha, the joy, the fun and the pleasure of that halacha. To the point that a person comes to it, that he feels the halacha as it stands is not enough for him, and he wants to go lifni meshuras hadin, then the halacha provides for him to undertake certain further structures in order to facilitate that growth to which he's striving.